Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 14th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Judy Saturin. Today's session number is 2 and is titled Understanding Madness, The Mentally Ill Among Us. Let's listen in.
I'm Judy Saturin, again, for those of you I haven't met yet this week, and I'm on the faculty at St. Olaf. And the topics that I have been addressing are in the area of mental health and mental illness, and this obviously relates to mental illness. Little different topics than some of the others that we've been doing. And I titled it Madness, and I did that purposely. The topics that I chose to focus on, I chose to do so because I do work with individuals who have mental illnesses, and I work primarily with nursing students in helping them learn how to work with individuals with mental illness. And a lot of my purpose in working with the nursing students is not, my expectation is not that they will become expert practitioners, but rather that they develop, the bottom line is that I want each one of them, when they graduate from St. Olaf or Gustavus, to have a fairly well-developed understanding of and sensitivity toward those with mental illness. That's really what I consider to be my most important mission. And that's, I guess, what I feel is important here too. And I don't know your backgrounds and where you're coming from and how much experience you've had with severely mentally ill individuals. I'd like to get something of a sense of that. But again, we talked about depression a couple days. That's something that all of us can understand at a certain level, because we have all, I think, experienced a degree of depression. The feelings that are associated with it, to some degree, we can identify with. And it's not quite as alien. And even so, individuals who suffer from depression, particularly major depression, are stigmatized, are misunderstood, the expectations are unrealistic. If you think about that, and then you think about something like a major mental illness, like schizophrenia, and that's the illness, psychotic illness that I'd like to use as an example. If you think about something like that, very few of us, although it's more prevalent than I think a lot of people realize, schizophrenia affects about 1 in 100 people in this country. So it's not rare by any stretch. But it's not something that in this room, my guess is that not many, if any, people have been directly affected. Certainly affected by it, because I'm hopeful in a way that some of you know individuals who carry that diagnosis. Or maybe have somebody, and when I say hopefully, it's because you may share some understanding, have somebody in your family that suffers from major mental illness. So it's a little harder to understand this one, I think. And these are individuals who are more and more out in the community. As you well know, they're not lodged primarily in state mental hospitals or private hospitals anymore. That's not where we are. These are folks who are out and about in our communities. They're in your church. They're in your community. They may not be as visible sometimes because it carries a great stigma. So the purpose here is basically I would like to look at it more from the inside out and see how we can understand it. If you've never experienced it, how is it possible to understand that internal experience of having an illness that really robs you of your ability to think logically, to relate to other people, to behave in ways that are socially appropriate? Very, very difficult. Very, very devastating illness. So that's really basically what I like to do, and then look a little bit about what is happening in the community. What's the impact of this illness? What happens to people as they're out on the street or in the shelter or in your church or whatever? How many people in this room, if you care to share, how many people know someone who is diagnosed with schizophrenia? All right. Okay. Anybody want to indicate what context that's in? Anybody wants to share that? How do you know that individual or individuals?
Would you give a definition, please?
Good. Let me ask you. what does that term, because that's an important kind of thing I'm glad you asked. What does that mean when you hear the term schizophrenia? Does anybody have an idea what that means?
I think of a double personality.
Okay. A split personality? Okay.
Hallucinations.
Okay. Hallucinations.
Paranoia.
Paranoia.
Hearing voices.
Hearing voices. Hallucinations. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is it split personality?
Split.
That's probably the most common understanding of what schizophrenia is, because literally it means splitting of the mind. So our assumption, I think, is that these are individuals who one day or one minute are acting in a certain way and then split into another personality. There are individuals with multiple personality. That's not what schizophrenia is. The survey was done among first-year college students, and about 65% of them believed that schizophrenia was some form of multiple personality. It actually isn't. What happens with schizophrenia is that the processes within the mind are fragmented. There isn't an actual splitting of personalities. You don't see different people. You see people that have behaviors that change, just like ours do, and sometimes rather dramatically, but it's the same person. What it actually is, again, and I talked about this with depression, but certainly with schizophrenia, we know that it is a brain disease. It's a disease, something is going on in the brain that is causing the individual to have these symptoms. Again, it's not something that the individual is doing purposely. It's not because of faulty parenting, which has been the prevalent view that somebody who is schizophrenic is that way because of the primarily mothering that they received early in life. Not a helpful kind of theory that we lived with for many years. I don't know if any of you heard the term schizophrenogenic mother. I did, because when I went to graduate school, the predominant theories were psychological. And if somebody had this disorder, it probably was the mother that was at fault, that was not nurturing, that was rejecting, that caused this illness. What we know about it today is that it is a disease, and it's a disease of the brain, which is why it makes it so difficult. It makes it difficult to understand, it makes it difficult to relate to, and it makes it very difficult for the individual with the disease to be able to get help and to accept help, because of the fact that if your brain is the organ that's diseased, the brain is the organ that can acknowledge that there's something wrong. If I start to have symptoms that relate to my cardiac system, I can identify that. I may deny a bit, but I can identify it. I can reason. I can understand that I need to get help for that. But if it's your brain that's diseased, if something is happening in your brain that prevents you from thinking logically, then you're not going to identify that there's something wrong and that you need treatment. So what you see with schizophrenia is somebody, and people identified some of the primary symptoms. You see people who don't think the way we do. Their logic and their reality is not the same as ours. Hallucinations is one of the hallmarks. That's a real key characteristic. Okay, people will hear voices, any variety of kinds of voices. Very devastating kind of experience. People will have delusions, believing that something is happening that really isn't happening. Every facet, for some individuals, not for all, and I want to make that point, there are variations within this disease like any other, but if I can just use kind of a severe example, it affects virtually every aspect of a person's functioning. Doesn't happen in some of the other illnesses. The person's thinking is disturbed. They interpret things differently. You can say something to them very straightforwardly and they don't hear it the same way. And part of that is because what's happening in the brain is that either they're not able to filter out stimulation and they're not able to hear what you're saying, they're distorting what you're saying. So the cognitive, the thinking is very much disturbed. The perception is disturbed. You hear voices. Normally, we don't do that. Their perception of their bodies, their perception of other people is disturbed. They may be looking at you, someone may be looking at you and seeing somebody that's very, very small or very large. That may be disturbed. behavior is certainly disordered. And this is part of the part of schizophrenia that's very difficult, because these are individuals who have severe schizophrenia. They're the individuals that you may see in the community, that you may have seen. Their behavior is often not something you want to get close to, right? They may have strange mannerisms. Their attention to their personal hygiene is often lacking. Many of them become overweight because of medications and inability to maintain a regular diet. They just don't present themselves very well, very often, particularly if they're not having some kind of effective treatment. So behavior, thinking, perception, you know, schizophrenia affects what the functions that make us most fully human. Our ability to think, to reason, to relate to other people effectively, to function socially. So it's kind of like the disease is the person, and obviously has great impact on the individual and the family. So it is a disease, it's not split personality. I want people to jump in again, because in an hour you can't possibly talk about something like this. So if there are things that you really want me to cover, just jump in. I want to just say a couple things about reality, because when you hear about schizophrenia, you hear schizophrenia, like any psychotic disorder, major mental disorder, really means the person has broken from reality. They're not perceiving reality the way you and I do. Now, one of the things about that I always like to point out is that what is reality? We have to be kind of careful in some ways. Now, the people that I work with are definitely suffering from a disease, and their reality is nowhere near other people's perception of it. But it's kind of interesting just to think about what reality is. Lily Tomlin, if you're familiar with Lily Tomlin, made a statement, the mind is like a pinata. You never know what you're going to get until you open it up. She said, when you have the pinata perspective, being crazy isn't so bad. What's so great about reality? It's just a collective hunch. A collective hunch is what reality is. You know, we come to some consensus, right? In this room, we have a consensus about what reality is. But it's still pretty subjective, okay? So I guess I always function on kind of a broad perspective, and I kind of like to hear other people's perceptions of what reality is. It's a little bit facetious, but with schizophrenics, the thing to remember is that they are behaving in a way that's consistent with their internal reality. That's important. That's an important point to keep in mind, because so much of what they do is so bizarre that people automatically just go, "Wah, you know, there's no getting into that. They're just way off in left field somewhere." They are responding to an internal reality that makes sense to them at the time. And I'll describe as well as I can what that might be like, because I think that's kind of the important point. So that if you interact with somebody or you're encountering somebody with schizophrenia, I think it does make a difference. You're more likely to try to talk with that person and understand why it is they're reacting the way they do, because they have a different reality at that time. Okay. And again, I want to be clear that I'm talking about people who are probably having a schizophrenic episode and are not being adequately treated. There is treatment, and it is quite effective for a number of individuals. However, schizophrenia as we know it now is not a disease that can be cured. It's a disease that very often is chronic, most often is chronic. People can be maintained very well by some of the new medications that are out. Can control the symptoms nicely, enable people to function in the community. But basically, it's a chronic disease, and they need to continue to be treated throughout the course of their lives. Yeah.
I have a sister that's schizophrenic, and one of the most difficult things dealing with her, she's had this now for 30-some years, and we've really come around, and finally, she's at a point where things are pretty good. The difficulty we've always had is that as we think things are going along fine with medication, all of a sudden we hear from her, from her husband or family, that she's just off the toots and just gone, and she's quit taking her medicine because that's part of the disease, apparently.
That's right.
And the other side of the coin was always difficult. So when we knew this was going bad, and it was south, we would say, let's get her in to the hospital and get her fixed. And they said, we can't do it unless she's a threat to society. So eventually, what happened, we just said, you've been in and out of the hospital so many times, you're going to go to the very serious Moose Lake or something, we said, and really push it and talk to the people. And I said, this is where you need to go. And she did get better. She is good now, and that's the best she's been because she took her medication.
Right. A couple of really important points you brought out. And one of them is that there is effective treatment. Unfortunately, it doesn't work for everybody. Some of the patients I work with simply don't respond well to meds, which is unfortunate. But the vast majority do. The problem is they don't take them. Unless somebody's hospitalized and supervised, they may not want to take them. And why don't they want to take them? Well, number one, they don't think they need them.
Yeah.
Right? The lack of insight because it's a brain disease and the brain isn't helping make sense out of this. Secondly, some of the newer medications now have fewer side effects, but basically the medications for schizophrenia have a lot of side effects, and they're not pleasant. Many of them are just inconvenient, but some of them are really nasty side effects. I don't know if you've ever seen somebody, probably have, walking down the street, and you know, they're kind of like this or this, right? That can be just some of the mannerisms of chronic schizophrenics. On the other hand, more than likely, those are side effects of medications. They affect neurological systems, and they cause shaking and internal restlessness and pacing. And have you seen anybody doing this? I mean, it can be other things, but we have patients, and it's just really sad because they need the meds to be able to function, but the meds cause sometimes what's called tardive dyskinesia. And you get this, and they can't help it. It's involuntary and sometimes permanent. And people look at them, right? They're out in the community, and they look at them and go, whoa, you know, there's nothing in here in this person. And they're aware of that. So that's another reason, very commonly, that they won't take their meds. First, they don't think they need them, and second, they don't like those side effects. How many of us are compliant all the time taking meds? I get on an antibiotic, and I know I need to take that duration, and I think, I'm over it now, I can quit. And that's really benign. So you imagine somebody who has to take these meds every day that makes him or her different from everybody else that they're around, and they don't feel good with them. That's the most common reason for relapse, for people being readmitted to the hospital. The second point you made was the difficulty in getting people in for treatment. This is where the impact on the family really comes in. And right now, I think generally, and I can speak best for Minnesota because that's what I'm familiar with, the commitment laws. We certainly can hospitalize people involuntarily, and schizophrenics are very often committed. The commitment laws have been leaning toward the side of the, if you want to put it that way, the individual. It's very difficult to get someone admitted to a hospital against his or her will without, you really have to prove danger to self or others, pretty imminent danger to self or others to get them committed. I'm all for the rights of mental patients, absolutely, because they've been abused incredibly in the past until fairly recently. So I think what's happened is we've swung. The pendulum has swung over. And who's borne the brunt of that? The family, the individual and the family. And there are a lot of people out in the street, and that's another important point, that are living out in the streets who are dying, literally, with their rights on. I mean, we talk about people dying with their boots on. These are people dying with their rights on. They have all their rights, but their need for and their right to have treatment is what sometimes is very difficult. So that's a real dilemma, and that's an ethical that has all kinds of implications, I think.
Yes, you see some people talking to themselves on the street. Just, I mean, they're agony. They're arguing with themselves.
Yes.
And like they're in misery.
Right. Yes, and that's an excellent point. You see people on the street. I see them in the hospital setting. who are hallucinating, who are very, very common with schizophrenia. And they're in agony, and I'm glad you brought up that term. They're people that sometimes other people will look at, as you can imagine, and laugh. There goes a real nut. Hallucinations are generally pretty devastating kinds of things. I've had patients who have running dialogues in their head all the time. They're hearing voices all the time. They never stop. Other people hear particular voices. They can identify who they are. They may be a parent or a spouse or whatever. They come and go. Sometimes people hear choirs of voices in their head and not able to control that. Very often the voices, as you would imagine, aren't saying things like, sometimes they do, but not very often, aren't saying things like, you're really wonderful. They're saying things like, you're really rotten, or you don't deserve to live, or things on that order. I remember a young patient that I worked with a number of years ago, and I had worked at the Veterans Hospital, so just to give you the context. He was probably 25 at the time I was working with him, who heard voices continuously. They were always with him, and we try to help people deal with them. Medication will help that, but for this particular person, it really didn't help a whole lot. And the voices he heard, primarily he heard his dad, and he'd had a lot of difficulty with his father, and they were very negative voices, telling him negative things about himself. He didn't deserve to live. He wasn't worth anything. We'd try the Walkman, we'd try everything to just block some of those out. Eventually he committed suicide, and that's not unusual. Suicide is definitely a risk factor for somebody who has hallucinations like that. He just could not, and he'd been suffering with the disease for a number of years, and he didn't see an end to that, and he could not deal with it anymore, and he committed suicide. And the psychiatrist and I that had been working with him, I mean, it's kind of an odd thing to say, but the first thing we said when we saw each other was, it's kind of a relief. That's how agonizing these voices were for him, and unfortunately, treatment didn't work for him. Now, that's not the typical situation. I mean, luckily, we have better treatment. But those are devastating, and anybody who hasn't experienced that, and I certainly have not experienced hallucinations per se, I think have a hard time understanding what it's like to live with that day to day to day. And always be misinterpreting what people are saying. Mm-hmm.
How difficult is it to diagnose schizophrenia? Because some of this behavior might be, just a mood swing or...
Right.
How can you tell it? That seems like a pretty heavy stigma to put on something.
It's a very, and that's an excellent point. Used to be real easy to diagnose schizophrenia. I've seen it, because I've been in the field for 20-some years. What's used to diagnose any mental disorder is what's called a Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's the psychiatrist's Bible. And it's become much more refined over the years. But 15, 20 years ago, somebody could come in. Let me give you an example that kind of maybe hits home a little bit. A middle-aged fellow came in, and from all we could tell, he heard voices and he had visions. And, other aspects of his personality were not real disorganized. I mean, sometimes it's really easy to tell. Everything is just disorganized in a person. But he really had these, and they were religious. He communicated directly with God. Now, that doesn't sound strange to anybody here. He had visions, and they were religious visions. Luckily, the psychiatrist that was working him up, that was assessing him, was careful. This doesn't always happen. He almost got a diagnosis of schizophrenia, because hallucination, and once anybody hallucinates, that's one of the first things it's got to be schizophrenia. But this psychiatrist, luckily, was a context-oriented person. You have to look at the context. Can't make a diagnosis without the cultural and social context. He was a very evangelical, he was in a Pentecostal, almost a cult, which may, seem to some of us kind of on the fringe. On the other hand, his behavior and his beliefs, when you put it in that context, were not psychotic. he was not functioning psychotically. And luckily, he avoided that, because once that diagnosis is put on somebody, it's really hard to get rid of it. So that has happened in the past, where somebody may have gotten a diagnosis. It happened a lot in the armed services, because that's what I'm familiar with. Diagnosis was much more slipshod. Now there is a whole list. Those of you who were at the depression class, same thing with that. There's a list of fairly specific, quite specific behaviors, a certain number of which have to occur over a period of time in order to be diagnosed. And for schizophrenia, I think it's 6 months or more that people have had to have a certain number of these characteristics: hallucinations, delusions, lack of motivation, inability to function interpersonally. There are a whole bunch of them. And it's a putting together quite carefully. Yeah.
I volunteer Friday nights at a homeless teen shelter, and I see teens probably that exhibit a lot of these traits, but I don't know if they're schizophrenic. They come from probably abused homes. They're taking LSD. They're taking PCP. They have no support system, so that they're really they are not taking care of their hygiene.
Right.
But they don't have a support system. I'm just wondering, and yet they may. You know, I don't know if they were diagnosed schizophrenic without the help or not for them.
Maybe for some, probably not for the majority, because the population you're describing, first of all, excuse me, the adolescent in the group, adolescent behavior in and of itself is crazy. right? And I'm being somewhat facetious, but think about it. I mean, you have to look at the developmental kind of level and look at what's normal compared to all other teens. And we look at it as adults and go, they could all be admitted sometimes. So, you know, you got to look at that. Plus the fact that the substance abuse is probably, for most of them, the real issue. For somebody who has, and again with depression, we've talked about having maybe a biological or genetic vulnerability to the disease, and you put stress on that and it may activate the disease. Probably what happens in schizophrenia, stress doesn't cause the disease. Okay? Emotional stress does not cause schizophrenia. But if somebody is predisposed, and who knows exactly what that is, but has that vulnerability, something like abuse of hallucinogenic drugs may trigger an episode, and there may be schizophrenia there. Schizophrenia generally appears in late adolescence, early adulthood. It hits people early, which is another part of why it's so devastating. And it's not surprising if you think about maybe they're vulnerable. And when are periods of great stress? Adolescence to adulthood, moving into that era. I've seen many people have an acute schizophrenic episode because of going into the service. So it kind of makes sense. But that's the kind of thing you want to be very, very careful about in terms of always putting it in the context. That would be the last thing I would want to, you know, see somebody diagnosed with.
Mm-hmm. Did you say, when you say predisposed or vulnerable to it, do you mean genetically?
Maybe.
You know, it may be genetic.
It may be. It's certainly not as nearly as strong evidence as with manic depressive illness. There's very strong evidence that there's a genetic link. What it is, they don't know. With schizophrenia, there are a lot of studies that are being done looking at that, and certainly the statistics show that, you know, if you have one parent with schizophrenia, your chances are much higher. If you have two, they're, you know, double. And again, you can't, you know, is it genetic? Is it the environment? Is it a combination? With all of these kinds of things, very likely there's a combination of things. But there is study looking at possible genetic transmission with schizophrenia. Again, we know, as we know with depression, that there's something going on in the brain. There is an alteration in their neurotransmitters and the substances that fire off the neurons, and medications bring those back into balance. So we know that there's some biological kind of connection with this. And we know that stress plays a big role in both bringing it out initially and in relapse. Yeah. But with kids, again, you've got to be real careful with that. But also know that it does, you know, early adulthood is when it, you know, may appear. Did you have?
Sometimes it gets better in late. And is there any evidence that some of that's hormonally tracked at all? And then my other question was about early diagnosis. If it is chronic, is it advantageous to have an early diagnosis, or do you wait until the manifestations are larger? You talked about mistakes in trying to make early diagnosis, and it seems like the mental health community is much more cautious in making early diagnosis. There's simply no advantage in it.
Not making early diagnosis, but making careless diagnosis, I think, is like it. Because there certainly are people that are young, and I'm not talking, let's say, early 20s, who over a period of 6 months to a year have exhibited these symptoms. Better to get that assessed and get treatment started. But what I'm saying is that diagnosis used to be made on the basis of some pretty flimsy evidence, not real careful, looking over time at the symptoms. But in my way of thinking, it's always best to get something early and to get it started. Treatment, because what happens with this kind of a disease, as you can imagine, it doesn't take long for the person to get into all kinds of difficulty. With substance abuse, if they're not detected and treated early, they're going to be abusing substances to try to cope. We have many people who deal with their voices and their unpleasant thoughts by drinking or using drugs just to try to self-medicate. That leads to a whole other set of problems. So the earlier that medical treatment can be initiated, the better. Is that okay? Let me just give you a couple. There are people too, I should say, I get carried away with this. This tends to be, I really have a lot of investment in this particular topic, so, go like this. Babbling, but the course of schizophrenia is very variable. I mean, there are individuals who have one episode, this is not the typical picture, and recover and go on and function and don't have another, and we see people with major depression like that. The majority of individuals with this disease, however, do go on. It does become chronic, and they need continued treatment. What happens with older people with schizophrenia, which is interesting, is that as they get into the older age group, the symptoms are less distressing. The symptoms kind of burn out a bit, and they actually function better as they get older. The most difficult population in terms of working with schizophrenia are the young. Today, there's a whole group of people out in the community. They're called the young adult chronic population. They're quite young adults who have chronic schizophrenia who have never been institutionalized because, again, the commitment laws have changed so much that most of the people with this disease are not in treatment facilities. They've never been institutionalized and they abuse drugs and alcohol. So they've got dual diagnosis, and I don't know if any of you know people who work with. Does anybody work with that population? That is one of the toughest populations to deal with. Very, very difficult. So that's one of the biggest issues for us now. And those are a number of the folks that are out and about on the streets and are causing some problems. By and large, people with schizophrenia, and this has always been my bias, sometimes people think that they're dangerous. That whenever you see the serial killer or the this or the that going on in the paper, people say, that person's crazy. There goes one. It's usually the other way around. These are people who are vulnerable to crime. They're the ones that are out there, and they're the ones that are very often the victims of crime. Except for this population that we're seeing now that has this particular combination of traits, and that's difficult to see. Are there other questions about kind of what it is or the, yeah?
Males and females.
Basically, what happens, it's interesting, the lifetime risk is about the same for men and women with this disease, but it hits men harder. That's what has come out recently, is that men seem to develop it earlier, and they seem to be hit harder with the symptoms. I don't know exactly why that is.
Maybe you've already said this. I haven't been able to hear quite all of what you're saying. I can't quite see you. I'm thinking about teenage crime. Did you say something about that? That this could be one of the causes that a lot of them are schizophrenic?
No, I don't think a lot of them.
Alcoholics?
complex? I think what we're seeing in the papers is a whole combination of factors, and the majority of those folks are not schizophrenic. What I'm saying is, because I always want to make the point, that this is not a dangerous population. Schizophrenics are not generally harmful. They're not going to be threatening to you. They're so afraid. What's happening to them is so frightening that they're the ones that are at risk of being hurt. It's just that we have now within that population this small group that they are getting into some criminal activity out there. But by and large, no, you don't have to be afraid of these folks. And that's kind of hard to believe when you see, and I was going to show just an excerpt from a video, but you know, it's so complicated here that I'm not going to do that. But a mother is talking about her son, who's 6'2", doesn't think he needs help. And when he has a relapse and they need to get him into the hospital and he's aggressive and she knows all about the disease, how difficult that is to deal with somebody who's big, and when they get frightened and when they hear voices, they get menacing. And so a lot of people have the perception that they're really very dangerous. The schizophrenics I've worked with have touched me because they are so vulnerable. They're very afraid. Mm-hmm.
Well, oftentimes you read the paper where a person has committed a murder because the person heard voices saying,
right,
that, you know, kill so-and-so.
That does happen. Command hallucinations are kind of a special category. And it's not real common among the population of schizophrenics. But again, somebody in another session was talking about they don't report it when a dog finds his way home or something. I don't know if any of you were in there. They don't report kind of good news. They pick out the really bad, sensational stuff. And that's what we tend to hear, but that does happen. And that's why it's so important if anybody is working with or living with somebody who has command hallucinations, voices telling them to do something, and it very often is to hurt themselves, that they pay very careful attention to that. That's a real...
That rather than be committed to prison, oftentimes the verdict is because of mental illness,
right,
that the person...
Right.
The whole person gets treatment.
Right. Yes, and those commitments are quite long. Yeah, exactly. On the other hand, there are many, when you bring up prison, I said that the majority of people with this illness are not necessarily in hospitals now. They're out in the community, and part of that community is in jail. A large number now of, what is it, about 10 to 15% of populations in prisons are mentally ill. And part of the reason for that is not because they're out there committing all these crimes, but because the alternatives in terms of treatment aren't available. One of my students came up and said, you know, my parents have friends who have a son who's in jail, and he's schizophrenic, and he really hasn't done anything. Is that legal? And I said, well, yeah. It may not be ethical, it may not be moral, but it's being done all the time because of a lack of facilities to treat individuals. Come out of the hospital, they go home, it doesn't work, you stop taking their medications, they go out into the community, they hit a shelter, they fix them up with a board and care, they leave that place, get back in the street, get back in the hospital, get back in the... It just becomes, you know, bouncing around from one place to another. So there are a lot of individuals that are in jail with schizophrenia, and not because they've committed terrible crimes. What I'd like to do, because I did say one of my purposes is to try to get a sense of what this disease might be like, is to just talk a little bit about how can we understand the disorder. Now, a fair number of you, and I'm frankly a little bit surprised, know somebody with schizophrenia, and with the stigma of schizophrenia, it's so hidden sometimes, and families don't talk about it. We just don't deal with it. It's nice that some of you have that experience. One of the ways to get to know what this illness is like is, the best way is to get to know somebody who has it. Make a point of doing that if this is something that you've always kind of stayed away from. If that isn't possible, and I've had a wonderful opportunity to do that because of the job I have, and I really do consider it a wonderful opportunity. I've met some incredible people with that disorder, but I know the person, and not the disorder. If you can't do that, then another good way is to use the literature to do that. And there are, not just because the bookstore wants me to do it, but because this is one I have a list, just four references, if you want to pick up one of those afterwards, that deal with schizophrenia from the inside out. They're accounts of individuals. This is a story of a young woman with schizophrenia. It's a very, very clear description of what the experience was like for her. And it's amazing that she can write. She wrote it with someone else, but write so clearly and so openly about her experience in and out of hospitals and the impact on her family. This is an excellent book. The bookstore, unfortunately, got it in hardcover, but I was just told that they're getting it in softcover, and if anybody's interested, they'll send it to you postage free. At any rate, The Quiet Room is one of the best, and that's another way to try to understand what the disease is like. Let me just give you a couple descriptions I've gotten from patients who have the disease. They use words like indescribable confusion, and these are articulate folks. Many of them are very articulate. One of the other misconceptions about schizophrenia, when you see some of the behaviors, is that it's these are people who are mentally retarded. Because the cognitive changes are so striking. They're not. There's a lot in there. But they talk about indescribable confusion. They talk about constant weird kinds of events, sensations. Talk about feeling like somebody has robbed them of their mind. That somebody has literally, and many patients will believe that somebody is putting thoughts into their head. I mean, literally inserting them or taking them out. Being dispossessed of one's mind and body. If you can imagine anything worse than feeling like you have, somebody else is just working up here. I mean, I feel like that periodically, but not every day. So they kind of see it as a cosmic catastrophe. Something, you have to make some sense of it, and something cosmically is just happening that's robbing them of their ability to function. Let me read you something that a schizophrenic person said to try to describe what it's like. She said, "What then does schizophrenia mean to me? It means fatigue and confusion. It means trying to separate every experience into the real and the unreal, and not sometimes being aware of where the edges overlap. It means trying to think straight when there is a maze of experiences getting in the way and when thoughts are continually being sucked out of your head so that you become embarrassed to speak at meetings. It means feeling sometimes that you're inside your head and you're watching yourself walking over your brain, or watching another girl wearing your clothes and carrying out actions as you think them. It means knowing that you're continually watched, that you can never succeed in life because the laws are all against you, and knowing that your ultimate destruction is never far away." You know, the magnitude of those kinds of feelings and trying to live with those on a day-to-day basis is incredible. And that's the kind of thing, if you can get those descriptions, then I think what happens is that you're kind of amazed, I am continuously, that these individuals function as well as they do. I mean, that they do what they do. And there are many individuals who are contributing very successfully to society that still deal with these kinds of feelings and thoughts. Since I teach at St. Olaf, after one of the mental health weeks, one of the students wrote a really nice article, helpful article about his brother who's schizophrenic. And just a real short excerpt from that, he said, "What does it mean to be schizophrenic? It means reading a book and getting stuck on the word be. The word grows in your mind and fills it so you can't think of anything else but be. It takes on new meanings or significance. What do they mean? Be, be. Be, be, be. Soon you have no choice but to put the book down and go to sleep. If you're asleep, and you don't have to know you're a paranoid schizophrenic." My brother sleeps a lot. And a lot of schizophrenics do sleep a lot. And it may be due to medication, but it's certainly very often is due to the fact that sometimes that's the only way they get any relief. And again, if you have a family member who's schizophrenic with all of these things going on, and they withdraw, and they sleep, and they're apathetic, and they very, very difficult, just as we talked about with depression.
So one of the ways is to read, to gain an understanding. A neurologist talked about the normal brain as an enchanted loom. I kind of like that. Those of you who are working on the loom might appreciate this. Taking threads of experience and you weave them into the fabric of life. That's a nice way to look at our brain. For people with schizophrenia, the loom is broken, and what you get is more like what happens in a wearing blender. That's what happens with schizophrenia. You don't get this weaving together, but rather fragments that are like what you get in a blender. So, you know, it's just a little touch of what some of the things they experience. Once you can kind of understand what the person is experiencing, it isn't surprising at all that you see some of the behaviors you do, that you see the guardedness, they're easily startled, they won't trust you, they're going to resist you. You know, it makes a lot more sense. And I had to learn that fairly early on if I was going to be of any assistance to people with schizophrenia. So just always think, what would it be like not to be able to trust your brain? That you really couldn't trust your brain. So that everything that happened, you're always wondering, now what is it that's going on? Anybody had experiences, you know, just thinking about those kinds of feelings, anybody had experiences that might or have given you some degree of understanding of what that's like? Somebody experienced some of this? Can you think of situations that might come close to this?
I had a stroke a couple years ago and I lost my balance, sense of balance, so vertical was no longer vertical. My brain was telling me this was vertical, but I was walking at 10 degrees or something, so it took me a long time to relearn where vertical was by just listening to my joints.
Right, because your brain wasn't telling you.
Right.
Yeah, you couldn't trust your brain.
Right.
Yeah, good.
Yeah. Well, this thing I ever came when I was helping my sister, a great deal with a lot of her problems, go to her group sessions and met her a lot in the hospital. And the only closest thing that I ever came to what you're saying was that after a very intense period of time of trying to help her and be with her, I was wondering if I was going crazy too. Mm-hmm. Because I was trying to get into her stuff and trying to figure out everything. And I didn't, but I mean, you just get into it and you wonder, on first here.
Yeah, that's right. There's a fine line, isn't there?
There is.
The line between sanity and madness has gotten kind of finer. And that's a really good point. You know, there is a danger there, I suppose. I don't think of it as a danger. I think of it as a real challenge.
It's a learning experience.
It's a learning experience, but you have to go into it knowing that you might very much be affected, which is a good thing. But you're absolutely right. You can, and I had to deal with that when I first started working with schizophrenics, because I wanted to understand so much that I would just be constantly thinking and identifying and really getting very close to individuals and their thinking. So there's always that danger, but then you all know that that's where the greatest rewards are. Anybody else had experience? Yeah.
When you say brain disease, are you talking like the neurotransmitters that are missing or are broken or not functioning?
The levels of neurotransmitters, there's an alteration in levels of neurotransmitters, the chemicals that carry the messages between brain cells, right? The little, you know, here we've got the cells, and the neurotransmitters are carrying those messages. And whether it's because there's dopamine, and I don't want to get real technical, but dopamine is a neurotransmitter that's implicated in schizophrenia. And individuals they don't have the level of dopamine that's necessary. So whether it's an actual change in the amount, or whether the receptors just aren't working, or whether there's a problem with the timing and the way that they're picking up,
so
don't know.
So it's partly chemical imbalance?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's probably a combination, but we know it's chemical imbalance. How many of you dream and remember your dreams?
How many what?
Dream. Have vivid dreams. Yeah. How many of you have awakened from a dream and for a period of time not known whether you're in the dream or you're in reality? That's usually this big a time, right? I've done that. I've had a couple really, really vivid dreams, and I did not know when I awoke where I was. I don't like that. I like being in control. I really do. So it's very difficult when you have that kind of situation. Anybody been delirious from a high temperature or from an illness or been in the hospital, which causes madness anyway? I mean, if you're really ill, right, and all the machines. And some of you who may have been hospitalized maybe years previously when we didn't know as much as we do now about what we do to patients in hospitals, and I'm talking about like ICUs. You get in ICU and the lights are on 24 hours a day and the machines are all going and people are going here and there and you're hooked up and your senses are, you know, blocked out. And what happens is people go crazy temporarily. Mm-hmm. There's an actual delirium that happens as a result of that. Sensory deprivation and overload. And that, if any of you have had that experience, that's a good one. You think about that, and then you think about what that felt like, and think about having to do that every day of your life. And sensory, the inability to filter out everything that's coming in is considered to be a deficit that schizophrenics have. You're sitting in here able to filter out, not everything, but probably about 80% of what's going on. So you can concentrate, and you can ask good questions. Schizophrenics lose that. So you'd say something to them, and in between you're saying it and they're getting it, there's all kinds of stuff happening in here, and so the answer you get might be way over here, because they're just not able to put it together and sort it out. Yeah?
I have a question about the past and now. I'm wondering if there used to be more schizophrenics in the world, I mean, the percentage of the population, there was a higher percentage in the past, or there's a higher percentage now. I'm wondering if our society cultivates schizophrenics with all of the TV that we have and the thousands of commercials and advertisements that are thrown at us every day, the hustle and bustle of the city, how many people you come in contact with that are not coming in contact with nature or the earth much anymore. It's just kind of concrete and steel and computers. I'm just wondering if we're cultivating a society of schizophrenics, and that we should be trying to change that.
Well, I don't know if literally we're doing that, but I think your point is very well taken, that we think about the barrage of stimulation that's occurring. It certainly doesn't make it any easier for somebody who has some deficits to begin with. And we all know that in continued environmental stress can create permanent changes in our immune system, in our, you know, what's happening in our biology. So we may very well see that. That's an interesting
point. Do you think there was a larger percentage of schizophrenics 500 years ago?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think that there may have. I'm just not aware of that. It isn't something that, at least I've seen in the literature, that there's been a great upsurge. Although certainly I think, you know, it's being recognized more. I mean, we all probably know individuals, those of us over the age of 25, who were in the communities who were very probably schizophrenic but never diagnosed and never treated by their behavior. Yeah, you have a question?
Yeah, I just read a report the other day just on what he was asking.
Good.
When a few years ago, it took 26 hours a day to feed yourself, and you couldn't function in life. You didn't live, and your family didn't let you live.
So now,
so today,
we are.
Where people live, and we help them live, there's more.
Well, I think that's.
But as a proportion of the population, I don't think so.
No. Yeah. Okay. So that, yeah, we are seeing more individuals. Same with a lot of things, because we are allowing them to continue. Yeah. Good. Good point. Just a couple other things. It would be helpful to think about situations that you've been in that kind of disorient you, to give you a sense of what this is like. It's like putting me in a parking lot, leaving my car somewhere, and going into a shopping center, and then coming out again. It happened one time, and I I don't know how long I spent. It seemed like an eternity. It was probably about 10 minutes. Walked right to where I left my car. Wasn't there. Didn't really bother me a whole lot. Walked back and just said, okay, I can think about this. I trusted my brain. I thought about it. Went up the next aisle. Wasn't there. I started to trust my brain just a little bit less. Started getting uncomfortable. What did I start doing? I started looking around to see if people were watching me. I really did, to see if they, you know, what's wrong with her. So I started getting a little paranoid, you know, after just two shots down the aisle. Tried another one, wasn't there. Then I really started to have trouble because what I thought was somebody has stolen my car. I had to find a reason for why my brain wasn't working for me. Only my car was a 1965 Volkswagen that had very few parts left. So it didn't make any sense, and yet there was no other explanation. And I really got, it felt just terrible. And that was a very benign experience. And as I said, it probably didn't last very long. I found my car. But I always remember that because I try to bring that up when I'm working with somebody with schizophrenia, to remember how that feels and to be very patient and to understand why they may react the way they do. So think about your ways. Well, another way to get a sensitivity is to go through an art museum and to pick out those pieces that really do portray some of the symptoms of schizophrenia. Picasso's good. Stand in front of Picasso's nude woman where the parts are all fragmented. And then think about somebody with schizophrenia who tends to have those fragments. They don't come together in a whole. Try to walk into the painting to do that. Or amongst the scream, that's an excellent one. Just stand in front of it and try to get into it, you know, if you dare, to try to do that, to feel that kind of panic and terror. So that's another kind of simple way to do it. But that's, I guess, what I feel is really important in understanding. It's not the symptoms, it's not the diagnosis, it's the what is this person experiencing. Questions, any questions about the disease or impact? Yeah.
What about the incidence? I mean, is any age group more prone to have schizophrenia? Do we have, what's the youngest age of schizophrenia? What's the oldest for a diagnosis?
Generally,
new diagnosis, yeah.
Generally, schizophrenia isn't diagnosed before about the age of 14. Now, there may be some indications, but that's generally, and I think part of that is real care not to diagnose something like that at an early age. It's diagnosed most frequently in late adolescence, early adulthood. That's when the most frequent diagnosis is. It's a chronic disease, so it affects people then throughout their lives. So that individuals, unless they have one episode, and I think maybe about 25% of individuals who have a diagnosis of schizophrenia have one episode, and are able to then go ahead and not have chronic schizophrenia. But the other 75% will have the disease, variable course of the disease throughout their lives. So again, it's a chronic disease. It's much like something like diabetes. When it's diagnosed, the person needs to be treated throughout their lives with insulin. They're maintained, but the disease isn't cured yet. We don't have a cure for it, but they can function very well. So I work with a population, and of course the population is aging, and the veteran population is aging, so there are a lot of individuals that continue to suffer with the disease, but as I said earlier, the symptoms are less devastating as people age. They're able to manage them better. So it's the young population that really, with acute schizophrenia, that's really the most difficult and causes lots of difficulties for families. Okay.
Is this ever triggered by misuse of drugs? I'm thinking of back in the 50s when we were having babies and they gave us Twilight Sleep, which was scopolamine and Demerol. And you didn't remember a thing that you'd had a baby at all. And
took a long time to wake up, and then the short-term memory was gone for quite a while afterward. Now, could something like that do damage that would start something?
It's conceivable. Anything's conceivable. When we're talking about something that's very complicated, and the hormones, and the, you know, all of that kind of thing, basically what we see is that, we mentioned this before, that people with underlying, if they have the predisposition, drugs of abuse will often trigger that. And that's why it's not uncommon in late adolescence when that behavior occurs, you know, fairly frequently, that it may bring out, it doesn't cause it, but it triggers the schizophrenia, right?
I just have a thought. Where does God relate to the schizophrenic? Our associate minister, Reed, my parish, I serve, her brother in Montana, has been institutionalized many, many, many times. And if I remember correctly, she says that he can't understand how God loves him. And his worth is just, you know, zero. And I don't know, have you experienced, you know, what do people say about God who are schizophrenic? Or what kind of relationship do they have with God or the church? Or?
The same relationship that all of us in this room, well, I shouldn't say all of us in the room. It's going to depend entirely on the individual. So there are individuals who have a very, very close relationship, very good spiritual life. And they're dealing with their disease, and they're, as anybody would with a chronic disease who has a good relationship with God and with their religion. There are many others, just as there are in the general population, who blame God for what's happened to them, who have a great deal of difficulty. We have patients in all ends. So it's the same as any other kind of disorder. Try to get chaplains involved definitely with patients with schizophrenia to help them with their spiritual distress, because any time anybody has a disease like this, there is a great deal of spiritual distress and working through it. But it's no different as what I've seen from any other person in the population. Yeah.
Well, the aging process creates behavioral problems, and my mother was diagnosed with dementia. She lived to be 97 years old. Mm-hmm. And she was hard to handle.
Sure. Yeah.
And was a woman who was ahead of her time. She needed to know or how to operate in a given situation, and it was heartbreaking to see this deterioration.
Yes. Yeah, and that's, you know, it's a different disease, but many of the same issues come up when you talk to family members who have to try to work with and deal with, and their hearts are breaking.
Yeah.
If you have a child who, for all practical purposes, is going through a normal childhood, you know, you're not seeing anything, in adolescence, develops schizophrenia, and you've got a different person in front of you. And I've heard family members talk about that. It's like they were hit by a train. Absolutely devastated, because it, as I said, it just affects everything about the person. Yeah.
I have a nephew that appears to be happening, and he's 18 now. When he was about 17 or 16, they started noticing kind of delusional thinking.
Mm-hmm.
He was sort of a savior kind of a thing. And he's on meds, and they've diagnosed him as sort of like pre-schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
Not knowing the situation, what is that? Is that just we're going to take more time to track it?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe showing some signs that could be, but maybe something else. And so I think that relates to what I said earlier, is that there's much more care given before making a definitive diagnosis of schizophrenia, because it does carry a real weight with it. Makes
well, I realize each case is different, but what are like warning signs? Like if you start to retell things that are just,
Basically, in adolescence, of course, what you want to look for, not just with this, but with things like depression, would be a change in behavior. Now, I realize that sounds odd, because adolescence behavior seems so erratic, but we always try to look for changes in their normal pattern of behavior. Certainly, if somebody starts getting very withdrawn, start spending more time in their room, and they haven't been a real solitary person, starts doing something differently, somebody who's, you know, any kid who starts using alcohol or drugs, you know, rather suddenly, you know, it may just be peer pressure, but it may very well be a response to symptoms that that person is experiencing, and they're not going to acknowledge them. So it's, you know, you have to go with those kind of overt behavioral signs. Sometimes they're not real clear. Sometimes it's the withdrawal, kind of a gradual withdrawal that people pick up on, and it takes a while to say, ooh, you know, something's different here. So my guess is that that's simply a matter of saying this could be a number of things going on, and before we diagnose, we want to have that over time kind of picture. Yeah. A couple things that might be useful, might not, but you know, I feel like I need to give them to you. When you asked about spirituality, anybody that's interested in resources for their church or people within their church, Dennis Bussey at the National, some of you may be familiar with him at the National headquarters, the Lutheran Church, has resources available for you on issues related to mental illness. There's somebody right here now, Jack Everett. He works some in the pottery shop, who has worked some chaplaincy kinds of things and has worked with the mentally ill. He's available as a resource. He also said there are some tapes. I haven't had much time to look at the library. Good tapes available. And what I always say is, if you have any questions, if you're dealing with something, if you have a family member, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, has chapters in every state, and all you need to do is call them. I think we need to organize a Mother's March Against Madness to try to get more resources into mental illness. You know, you see, how many of you live in areas where you see all the marches and the, you know, the runs and the walks and the whatever? We need one for madness to get some money. I know people have to leave because you're probably hungry for rice.
Yes.
For lunch. But I just want to put this up and see if it means anything to you. Leave you with a little something. Can you read that? All my life I lived in a coconut. It was cramped and dark, especially in the morning when I had shade. But what pained me most was that I had no way to get in touch with the outside world. If no one out there happened to find the coconut, if no one cracked it, then I was doomed to live all my life in the coconut and maybe even die there. I died in the coconut. A couple of years later, they found the coconut, cracked it, found me shrunk and crumpled inside. What an accident. If only we'd found it earlier, and maybe we could have saved him. Maybe there are more of them locked in like that, who we might be able to save. They said and started knocking to pieces every coconut within reach. No use, meaningless, waste of time. A person who chooses to live in a coconut, such a nut is one in a million. But I have a brother-in-law who doesn't need one. Mm-hmm. So, on that note, thank you very much for your input. Very helpful.